years of independent, listener-sponsored free speech radio.
And that's 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, California, 94.1, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online and archived at www.kpfa.org. Next up, Guns and Butter with Bonnie Faulkner, followed by Bay Native Circle at 2 and special programming at 2:30.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Basically, the financial sector are the barbarians at the gate. And if you're going to attack an economy and do what barbarians do, which is grab the land and make the people pay rent, issue yourself monopolies, and make yourself the hereditary government, of course you want to call the defending population terrorists. And that's exactly, you know, what's happened today. When America invades the country and calls the defenders who fight back terrorists, it's very much as if the British would have called the American revolutionaries terrorists.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, The Financial Barbarians at the Gate. Dr. Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. He is also author of The Myth of Aid and Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order. Dr. Hudson has written several recent articles on the global financial crisis, including The Financial War Against Iceland, Being Defeated by Debt is as Deadly as Outright Military Warfare, Financial Crisis, Sustaining Unsustainability, $1 trillion more to sustain the economic crisis, G20 message to indebted countries, drop dead, Economic Meltdown, the dollar glut is what finances America's military buildup, the U.S. payments deficit stems from military spending, How the Scam Works, The Free Market at Work Financial Style, The Real AIG Conspiracy, among many other articles. Dr. Michael Hudson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
You've just returned from Europe. What countries did you visit, and what was the reason for your trip?
The Basque country and Iceland. In the Basque country, I was brought there by one of their labor unions to help draft a tax policy for them. And I met with most of the LAB union leaders. And when I was there, they called a general strike, not so much to protest, but for an education day on May 21st to go over about 20 of my columns to educate the union members in what kind of economic policy to push for. Then I went to Iceland, which is in a lot of problems because it's somewhat of a post-feudal economy where, the Basque country, it's very egalitarian for most people, very middle class, but a few feudal lords at the top. And the feudal lords had got together and formed banks, all of which had gone bankrupt by last fall and owed a huge amount of money. England, in order to protect its depositors, declared Iceland a terrorist country and grabbed all the deposits as if it were under attack. And that offended the Icelanders. And they're having an election coming up later this month to decide what to do. The population is divided over whether it's liable for the debts run up fraudulently by the crooks who ran the banks and are now hiding out in England with their Russian counterparts. I'd never been to Iceland before. And what I realized is that it's really like a post-Soviet economy. There's a small group of kleptocrats at the top that are running the rest of the economy without the rest of the economy having much say, because the kleptocrats are really part of the government there. That may change in the upcoming election. It was quite an experience. The difference is that the Icelandic kleptocrats have been there for century after century running the land and abusing the rest of the population. And it shows me how much similarity there is between the post-communist, post-Soviet economies and the post-feudal economy of Iceland.
Now, you just mentioned that the British had accused Iceland of terrorism, and that reminds me of something that I read in one of your articles.
They didn't really accuse them of terrorism. They put them on the terrorist list. Even the British are not so corrupt. Well, they are so corrupt, but almost not so corrupt as to really believe the Icelandics are terrorists. They merely wanted an excuse to grab their money. The English are in the role of pirates.
Well, what I was about to say was, in one of your articles, you have a section on neoliberals playing the terrorist card, something like that, as part of their financial extraction. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. Basically, the financial sector are the barbarians at the gate. And if you're going to attack an economy and do what barbarians do, which is grab the land and make the people pay rent, issue yourself monopolies, and make yourself the hereditary government, of course you want to call the defending population terrorists. And that's exactly what's happened today. When America invades the country and calls the defenders who fight back terrorists, it's very much as if the British would have called the American revolutionaries terrorists. Britain had a terrorist list which enables it to grab whatever money or assets it wants from other countries. So when it acts as the homeland to accept the Icelandic post-feudal ruling class, and the Icelandic nobles go to England and buy the soccer team, just like their Russian kleptocrat counterparts, of course England is going to call them terrorists when it grabs their money.
Of course, we've spoken at length before about an upcoming depression. In your view, sort of simply put, which countries do you think will weather this coming financial storm better, the European countries or the United States?
Probably the United States, because it acts in its own self-interest, and Europe acts in America's self-interest. There's no feeling of European self-interest there. As far as Europe is concerned, there is a class war of finance against labor, and the one thing that all the European politicians agree on is that they bitterly hate labor, and they want to reduce wages as much as they can. They're glad to see the recession because it's a golden opportunity to squeeze down labor's wages, and they are quite happy to see their domestic market shrivel up. America, I don't see doing that. Europe is self-destructive, and if anything, it has a death wish.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because so many people point to their a social safety net. They say that it's much better than the United States. They're in better shape to weather this. As well, the United States is very anti-labor additionally.
All that's true. It is true that Europe has a good public medicine at a much lower price than the United States. Unfortunately, it doesn't have many jobs for the labor force right now, and it's put much of its savings in the United States rather than developing the internal market. The European government, Europe is not a democracy. It's basically a kleptocracy moving back as quickly as it can towards feudalism. The European Central Bank is autonomous from any control by elected representatives, and it essentially has the policy of price stability, which it construes as lowering wages by as much as possible. So the problem is that there really aren't any jobs there, and Europe would rather give away its export for nothing except treasury bills to the United States than actually sell them to a prosperous labor force. The class war is still so vicious there, and Europe has never really emerged from feudalism. There's still an aristocracy. There's still a subservience to inherited wealth. Whenever I go to Europe, I'm so glad I'm born an American, because I've never experienced here this kind of sucking up quality to wealth and to birth and heritage that you find over there.
Yes, that's very interesting. Dr. Hudson, what do you think is the single most important thing for people to understand about the current economic meltdown?
that it's going to get much worse financially, and that there has been no bailout of debtors at all, and that the debt problem is going to continue to deflate the economy, that employment will go down. And basically, if you want to see our future, look at what happened in Russia under Yeltsin, Yeltsin's Russia, because the architects of Yeltsin's kleptocracy and depression are now in charge of economic policy here. Larry Summers, Geithner, the whole Clinton Rubenomics team is now in charge of our financial policy here. And they are just as right-wing as the European financial managers. They know that the game is up, and they're trying to grab as much public money as they can before people stop them from grabbing. And they're not trying to help the economy at all. They're trying to help themselves. And if you want to see a foretaste of what policies they were able to enact when they had a free hand in Russia, just look at what they did then and see whether they're going to try to do the same here.
You write that the supremacy of the banks and the financial sector took thousands of years to achieve, and that allowing economies to be crippled with interest payments was unthinkable until recently. How was this financial supremacy achieved?
Well, in the beginning, the first creditors in the first issue of money back in the third millennium B.C. were the temples and the palaces of Sumer and Babylonia. And down through classical antiquity, most debts were owed to the government as taxes and user fees or tribute if they were colonies. There was very little private banking as such, and almost no credit creation. That changed basically in the medieval period when kingdoms were formed, and they had to borrow for two reasons. One was to pay tribute to Rome, Peter's pence and other capital transfers to the papacy, and the other was for war. And it was the need for war that enabled private bankers to emulate the contract policies that the Templars and Hospitallers and other church orders had developed in the 12th and 13th century to finance the Crusades. And so in the wake of the Crusades, which looted Byzantium and brought gold and silver into Europe, very much like after Columbus discovered the New World, this created fortunes for Venice and for the large Italian cities, and their bankers developed, and then banking spread throughout Europe. And the idea of public debts, mainly war debts, came into being. These were completely lacking in antiquity. There was no concept of running into debt. All governments financed themselves on a pay-as-you-go basis. Sometimes palaces would borrow from temples, but the palaces and temples together were public institutions. There was no credit creation, and especially no free credit creation as a private monopoly to lend money to governments and extract interest that would be backed by taxes. All that is in the last few hundred years. And even as it developed, there was a response by the population at large that they had to prevent finance from just crushing the economy. And the laws from the 13th century down to about 1980 all favored debtors much more than creditors. The usury laws steadily lowered the interest rates. Bankruptcy laws made debtors' prisons a thing of the past and enabled individuals to wipe out their debts and start over. Truth in lending laws, regulation of the banks, and all of this sort of culminated in the 1930s after the financial system plunged the whole world into depression. Nobody really expected the financial sector to fight back and to be able to somehow convince the people that it was right to take over government, and centralized planning was all very good as long as the government did it. So the people somehow have bought the myth that a free market means a market free of government regulations, free for financial predators, free of the government to impose truth in lending, to prevent fraud, free of police over the financial sector. And in fact, even in today's Financial Times, there's a report that the U.S. government has a prosecutor and has found almost all of the banks that have been receiving the government bailouts have been acting in a fraudulent way. Not a word in the American press about this, but basically the American large financial institutions, certainly the large banks, are all crooks. Citibank, Bank of America, Countrywide, all have engaged in deliberate fraud, wholesale fraud, and corruption. And this is being noted all over Europe. It's in the European press. Not a word of it here. It's as if the financial crooks are the only thing protecting us from a government takeover, whereas in reality, the government is the only organization and institution that can protect us from fraudulent finance and protect us from the new barbarians at the gate.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, The Financial Barbarians at the Gate. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You have written that we are now emerging from a financially unique period of history. Never before have people believed that the way to get rich was by running into debt. 1980 was the turning point. What happened in 1980 to change things?
Well, interest rates were 20% back in 1980, and you had Reagan come in and begin to shift taxes off property and on to labor and consumer goods. So what happened was that what used to be taxes on wealth, taxes on the upper income brackets, and taxes on real estate, now being freed, and whatever the tax collector refrained from collecting was available for bidders to bid against each other and pay as interest to banks in exchange for the credit to buy property. So all of this credit came into basically the real estate market and the stock market, and interest rates came down as Alan Greenspan flooded the market with credit. Down payments were reduced from the usual 20% down to just about zero. Instead of 30-year mortgages that would be paid off over the working life of people, you had zero amortization mortgages and even negative mortgages where the banks would simply add the interest rate onto the price. And finally, the biggest banks, Citibank, Bank of America, realized that they could simply falsify records and cheat people and write mortgages that had no relationship either to the property's value or to the debtor's ability to pay, and sell them to gullible European bankers who somehow had faith in America. And so you had the largest American banks essentially become criminalized organizations and put so much money into the real estate market that everybody thought, well, gee, all we have to do is borrow money at, say, 6%, and as long as housing prices are going up by 10% a year, we don't have to put any money down. We pay the 6% to the bank, and we get a 10% rate of return. We can simply refinance the mortgage every year or two and borrow the money to pay the interest, and for almost no money down, we get a free ride on asset price inflation. And this was Alan Greenspan's neoliberal idea of wealth creation. Wealth creation had nothing to do with increasing the means of production, increasing industrial investment, agricultural investment, or building infrastructure. In fact, it was dismantling investment and downsizing firms and carving them up. But what Greenspan did was simply inflate asset prices, and people thought that they could get rich somehow by financial engineering of the balance sheet rather than actual tangible investment or the kind of expansion of industrial capitalism that one reads about in all the textbooks.
You know, Dr. Hudson, you gave a very good illustration in one of your articles, I think your article on Iceland, to explain to people why asset inflation is not good. You wrote, and I think this is instructive for people to understand. It says, consider an attractively priced home. Would you rather own 100% of a home free of all debt with a market value of 100,000 euros, if free of debt, or would you rather own 60% of the same home at an inflated market value at 250,000 euros. In the second scenario, you would have 50,000 euros of surplus wealth, because obviously the price, the so-called value of it, would be higher. You've got 60% times 250,000 equals 150,000 euros compared to 100,000 in the first example. So, I mean, even though you only own 60% of the house, it was still supposedly worth more. Then you go on to say, people across the globe have been convinced that the second scenario represents wealth creation. What is overlooked is that the higher priced home carries interest charges on its higher market price. This charge would amount to 6,000 euros a year, or 500 euros a month at 6% interest. The same property is worth more, but includes a much larger debt overhead income for the financial sector. So that all that's happening really is that you owe the banks more in interest. Is that right?
That's right. The same thing is here for dollars. And that's the thing. The idea of buying real estate, especially if you're an investor like Donald Trump or a commercial investor, the idea is that rent is for paying interest. And basically, landlords will go out, they'll look at a building, they'll calculate how much rent is available after they meet the carrying charges, and they'll pay all of this rent to the bank as interest in exchange for a loan to buy it. And they're willing to give all this income to the bank in exchange for selling it at a capital gain, because they think, well, as interest rates come down more and as the economy is inflated, I'm buying an inflation hedge and I can always sell at a capital gain. And the government encourages this, and the government encourages it in two ways. First of all, it only taxes capital gains at half the rate of earned income, wages and profit, and in fact, it doesn't collect capital gains tax at all if you just reinvest your wealth and making more and more wealth. So essentially, your gain is tax-free if you're a real estate investor. And secondly, the government lets interest charges be tax-exempt. Now, everybody in the 19th century, all the major economists since the Saint-Simonians in France, thought that the idea of industrial investment should be that banks should make loans against profit. That way, if the profits go up, the bank gets more. If there is a recession and the profit rate goes down, the bank gets less. Otherwise, you're going to have a forfeiture of property to the bankers. Instead of favoring equity investment, the financial sector has essentially bribed and financed government officials to encourage debt financing. And what that does is load the economy down with debt charges, and whatever is paid as debt is tax exempt, so that the borrower has much more money that he can pay a banker than if he pays dividends on stock, which are paid on an after-tax basis. So there's an asymmetry in the American economy and just about all the other Western economies to favor the bankers in debt instead of favoring equity. And that's why the economies throughout the world are all collapsing under the debt burden today.
Yes, and I believe this subject first came up in a few of our shows several years ago when you were explaining why cutting property taxes doesn't really benefit homeowners or even renters, because all the money that would have gone to pay taxes to the government is now extracted by the banks in interest.
That's exactly right. Whatever the tax collector gives up is free to be paid for the bankers. But meanwhile, since the tax collector isn't getting the property tax anymore, it has to raise the money somewhere else. And either it taxes income, mainly labor income, or it taxes sales, so that sales taxes fall on consumers, or it borrows money from the wealthy people from whom it used to tax. So instead of taxing wealth, it now borrows from them and pays them interest. This is just the opposite of what everybody expected to see under a system of progressive taxation.
Right, and I think it's something that is not obvious to people. They think if their property taxes are low, that they're getting a deal.
In the short term, that's right. So they're taking a phenomenological approach. They look at the surface, and in the short term, of course, if the property tax goes up, they have to pay more. But when things even out, when market forces work, people are not going to be able to borrow as much against the free rent if there's a heavy tax. And ideally, if you had a tax system that collected all of the land rent, then people could borrow from the banks to build buildings and pay a return, but they couldn't borrow against the land's rising site value or price, and the government would have this property tax, which is now a free lunch, and it wouldn't have to levy a local income tax or local sales taxes or the other kinds of taxes that governments levy. They'd tax wealth, which is exactly what happened throughout antiquity, when by far the major tax was fell on the land, because that's where all the wealth was, and that was the only way that you could see how much wealth somebody had. So all of this that we're seeing today, this tax system, turns upside down the kind of tax philosophy that civilization has had for 4,000 years.
As well, you've written that central banks swamp economies with easy credit, that is, with debt, that keeps the financial sector fat while impoverishing the increasingly indebted nation. Is this what is happening today with the bailouts? This sounds like what you've been describing.
Well, yes, but not in the usual way. The bailout does create debt. The government is doing a cash for trash swap, where the government takes junk mortgages, many of them fraudulent, many of them about to be prosecuted for criminal felony, I believe, and has given them good government bonds, newly printed, that are going to have to pay interest by levying taxes on the population as a whole. So the banks themselves were supposed to turn around and levy debt. Essentially, what Geithner has said was the solution to an over-indebted economy is lend even more money, inflate prices even more. We've got to make housing prices higher, and lend enough money so they can pay the banks, so that the banks that have been doing all of this crooked activity can continue to collect on the credit that they've created and extract even more from the economy. So Geithner is supporting the financial sector against the rest of the economy, and Obama apparently believes that the best solution for America is to lower wages, take-home wages and disposable income by about 20%, and give money away to his largest campaign contributors, the financial sector.
You were a balance of payments economist on Wall Street for 40 years. Exactly what was it that you did?
Well, for Chase Manhattan, my job was to look at third world countries and estimate how much can they afford to borrow. And the way in which I do that would, I'd say, how much can they afford to export? How much of their infrastructure can they sell off? And if they can export, say, $10 billion a year, then that will carry a loan at 5% of 20 times that. So that'd be like a $200 billion or so. And then I'd calculate what proportion of the overall foreign debt does Chase Manhattan have, and I'd say this is sort of what I believe our quota could be. Underlying that calculation was the assumption that whatever a third world country could generate over and above subsistence, all the income that normally would go to labor would go to paying the banks. All the export proceeds would go to pay the banks. All the profits would go to pay the banks. Everything the government could tax would go to pay the foreign banks. So the idea was how much of a surplus could be squeezed out of these economies, keeping them poor, keeping them in poverty, but enriching Wall Street. And that was how I learned about how to do the balance of payments and how banking worked. I then went to work for Arthur Andersen doing the U.S. balance of payments. These were during the Vietnam War years in the late 60s, when I found out that the entire U.S. balance of payments deficit was military in character. The private sector was exactly in balance. The military was running the deficit. And then later on, I continued to do balance of payments consulting, I guess down through the 1990s for Chase and for various Wall Street clients in the intervening decades.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, The Financial Barbarians at the Gate.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Why do you now say that your seminal book published in 1972, Super Imperialism, should have been titled Monetary Imperialism?
Because super imperialism sounds sort of pop. And the form of imperialism that America did is different from the kind of imperialism that people think of in terms of European colonialism. Unlike England, the United States didn't have to invade countries, at least before the oil grab in Iraq and the Near East. It got a free ride and drained other countries by the international monetary system's workings. As long as foreign countries kept their reserves of the central banks in the form of treasury bonds, this meant that however much foreign countries would export and earn on balance, they would lend to the U.S. Treasury, which would finance the U.S. Balance of payments deficit, and this would also finance the budget deficit, because the foreign central banks became the largest buyers of U.S. Treasury bills, so that Americans didn't have to finance their federal government's budget deficit. Now, half of the federal government's discretionary spending, as Ralph Nader pointed out a few weeks ago, is military in character. So foreign central banks, by keeping their reserves in dollars, essentially finance the U.S. Government's military spending throughout the world, surrounding them to prevent them really from trying to break away from this exploitative free lunch that we're getting by the fact that we print paper dollars and we get their exports, American investors get to buy their industry, and all they get are paper dollars in amounts that can never, ever be repaid. So that while the United States insists that third world countries and other countries repay its debt to it, it has no intention ever of repaying its debt to them. It's a free ride, and it's a purely exploitative relationship.
Well, speaking of the dollar, there's been talk lately, particularly from China, but a few other countries, of replacing the dollar as the global reserve currency and coming up with some sort of a fictitious currency that would sit on top of all of the national currencies and be used, I guess, for international trade, etc. What do you think of this idea?
There's a myth that the balance of payments deficit is trade. It's not trade, it's military. When they say finance America's trade deficit, what they mean is our military spending abroad. Don't use the euphemism of trade deficit for our military spending and our empire building and our aggressive wars in the Near East. So it's military. What China did basically was saying, we want to avoid getting any more dollars. We know that America is not going to pay the $2 trillion that we have. We know that America is running a trade deficit, and it's running a military deficit as well. So that about a month ago, when Coca-Cola tried to buy China's largest fruit juice distributor for I think a few billion dollars, China said, no, we're not going to give away our companies for your damn paper. If we let Coca-Cola buy our fruit juice distributor for $2 billion, the local Chinese seller is going to turn this dollar inflow over to the central bank in order to get our domestic currency, the yuan. The central bank is then going to have to decide what to do with this $2 billion, and it will buy treasury bills to finance the government, to surround us with atom bombs and armies to try to invade us if we ever say, no, we don't want any more of your damn dollars. So of course they said no. They wanted to stop America's military aggression. And China's aim is primarily just to be left in peace without being attacked militarily. The U.S. government is threatening the whole world militarily by saying, if you do not accept our dollars, we will treat that as an act of war. And in 1974, Herman Kahn and I went down to the White House and met with the Treasury when the Treasury Secretary explained to us that they told OPEC that OPEC could charge whatever it wanted for its oil, but it had to invest all of its profits on the oil back in the United States. If it didn't, that would be an act of war, and we would kill them, and there would be a revolution. That is the new imperialism, that America will make a revolution, murder elected leaders, as it did in Chile, if they choose not to export to the United States for dollars, or if they refuse to accept dollars in exchange for their industry. This is utterly imperialistic system. It works through the monetary system, and it is a quid without quo. It's purely a free lunch, and the U.S. government has fought any monetary reform because it wants to continue to get a free lunch, mainly because without the free lunch, it could not afford the military bases that it's putting all over the world to threaten other countries to remain in the American monetary system.
Right, but what about these comments about getting rid of the dollar as the reserve currency? I read somewhere in the paper that even Geithner, the head of the Treasury, sort of slipped up and said, well, maybe they'd go for a new kind of international reserve currency, and then he retracted his statement. So are you saying that there's no way that the United States would ever agree to such a thing?
There's one way the United States would agree to it, and that is if foreign central banks would take their treasury bills and essentially turn them into the IMF in exchange for what's called paper gold, which would be IMF play money. The IMF would then tear up all of the treasury bills, so the U.S. would no longer owe $4 trillion to foreign central banks. It would owe nothing to foreign banks. And instead, foreign banks would get play money to exchange this paper gold. The United States would love that. That's the only kind of alternative IMF currency it would accept. Obviously, foreign countries, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, will not go along with this because their whole idea is to reform the monetary system to prevent America's military attack on them.
Okay, so you're saying that either way it wouldn't make any difference. We're still talking about U.S. imperialism through the monetary system.
That's correct.
Do you think that the game is over in terms of neoliberal economic policies imposed on the rest of the world?
You don't know. The government is trying to prevent any alternative from being voiced, and it has the support of the economics profession, which is almost entirely in the hands of neoliberals from the Chicago School and the Harvard Economics Department, the far right of the political spectrum. And as long as people are not informed that there is an alternative, namely classical economics, and as long as they're not taught economic history, as long as they can censor economic thought from the academic curriculum, people are not going to have any idea of what Adam Smith or Ricardo or John Stuart Mill or Henry George or Marx really wrote at all, and they'll believe that there's only one kind of economics, and that's the neoliberal, really neo-feudal economics that's taught by the Chicago School. As long as the financial sector can block a knowledge of the alternative, people will feel that there's no alternative.
Is the expansion of fictitious capital, that is the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, an inherent characteristic of capitalist development? I hear a lot about the falling rate of profit being at the root of the financialization of the economy today. Do you think this is true? And in your opinion, was it inevitable?
It certainly was not inevitable. Matters didn't have to be this way, and they don't have to be this way. The financial and real estate sector basically are a legacy of the military conquests that shaped feudal Europe. The land rent is largely the legacy to a landed aristocracy that were the heirs of the military warlords and vandals who took over most of the European countries. And as I mentioned, the private banking was a legacy of the Crusades and of the war lending that shaped European kingdoms in the Middle Ages. I don't like to use the word falling rate of profit because the term itself is a Marxist term. And when Marx used it, He expected the Industrial Revolution to have more and more capital investment per unit. He thought that labor productivity would rise steadily by technology embodied in more and more capital per worker. Now, in fact, that trend hasn't borne out over time. There's not more and more capital per industrial worker. Many of the innovations are capital saving as well as labor saving. What there usually is more and more energy per worker, but that doesn't entail a larger capital expense. Well, what Marx said was that the earlier economics, from Canet and the physiocrats down through Adam Smith, that economists had left out an element of value that was very important, and that was the depreciation on the machinery. And Marx said, if a capitalist, an industrialist, invests in machinery and plant and equipment, they have to recover the cost that they've spent on this plant and equipment. Just as a bondholder would not only get interest, they'd get the principal, the capitalist not only makes a profit on his investment, but as the machinery wears out, he gets to recapture the capital that he actually put into the machinery so that he can buy new machinery and upgrade. And Marx added that even if the machinery doesn't wear out, it becomes technologically obsolete as efficiency and productivity of new inventions rise. So Marx said, as there's more and more capital relative to the cash flow that corporations earn, there's going to be less and less profit relative to this cash flow. So all Marx meant when he talked about the falling rate of profit was a rising rate of depreciation. Now, I've heard many Marxists give talks over the last four decades, and I've never met one who understood really what depreciation was. And they think that profits fall because wages go up, and very few socialists and Marxists actually read Capital. Some do, but when I grew up, just about everybody I knew was a Marxist because of my family, and not a single socialist leader or labor leader that I knew had ever actually read Capital. But they all knew about the phrase falling rate of profit, so I don't want to use it. Today, profits are falling for quite a different reason that neither Marx nor anybody else in the 19th century could have guessed. And profits are falling because corporate raiders and ambitious conglomerate builders are borrowing the money to buy other firms, and so profit are being used to pay interest to bondholders. So cash flow is being crowded out, not by payment for machinery and depreciating machinery, but by paying more and more debt service to the creditors. And that's something that nobody in the 19th century really believed would happen. They anticipated that finance was going to be a handmaiden for industrial capitalism, that it would finance capital investment, not dismantle it, downsize it, and outsource the labor force. Nobody anticipated that the financial sector would turn as perverse as it's done really in the last three decades.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, The Financial Barbarians at the Gate. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'm glad that you've discussed this concept of falling rate of profit, because I always hear this bandied about, and it's never really been clear what exactly the theory is. So thank you for that.
Well, Marx went over this particularly in his theories of surplus value, which originally he'd planned to make the first volume of Capital. And that itself is in three books. It's as long as Capital. And in fact, Engels and then Kautsky made much of the second and third volumes of Capital off the manuscript of Marx's theories of surplus value. And the first translation into English was by my own mentor, Terence McCarthy. And in his introduction to that in 1952, which he translated under the title A History of Economic Doctrines, he explains the role of depreciation and called Marx really the first modern cost accountant, because value theory is basically a theory of the necessary costs that go into producing goods and services. And Marx's theory of surplus value was the first history of economic thought that really reviewed in a critical fashion what kind of costs were socially necessary and what kind of costs were not necessary, namely rent and interest, that were the topics of the second and third books of the series of surplus value, and also the second and third volumes of Capital, respectively. Very few Marxists really get into the second or the third volume of Capital, but especially the third volume of Capital is where Marx gets into the fact that finance grows not as a reflection of the rate of profit, but purely autonomous mathematical laws independently of the capital process. And the danger, Marx thought, was that finance would break free of industrial capital and rather than being industrialized, as he hoped to see, would take on a life of its own and end up stifling industrial investment. And in fact, that's exactly what's happened.
Well, that's very interesting. I have here a quote from one of the articles you've written lately. It says, Marx was an optimist when it came to his expectations for how banking would evolve.
He thought that that industrial capitalism would be run by the industrialists with a view towards accumulating more and more physical capital to expand markets. And contra Ricardo, Marx said that there could not be a permanent crisis under industrial capitalism because capitalists would continue to make innovations and invest in cost-cutting innovations to undersell their competitors. Well, of course, this is obviously where Schumpeter got much of his ideas about innovation. And Marx believed that with industrialists influencing governments and with governments believing that their best hope for national advance, including military advance, was going to be by building up industry, that industry and the government together would subordinate finance to serve the needs of industry. And in fact, industry is now being carved up to make short-term gains for the financial sector in a way that nobody really expected. Engels, in a footnote to the third volume of Capital, said Marx was always a follower of the French Saint-Simonian, Saint-Simon, who wanted to shift banking away from the creation of debt and credit into something much more like a mutual fund, like you had with French banking in the from the 1860s and 70s, and later German industrial banking and Central Europe banking, where you had banking allied with industry much more. After World War I, and especially after World War II, because England and America basically won the war, they dismantled the German industrial banking system and replaced it with a kind of ripoff banking, especially real estate banking, that you have today with the Anglo-American banking system, not the German and later the Japanese industrial banking system. That's something that nobody in the 19th century could have anticipated, the dominance of finance over industry rather than of industrial capitalism over finance.
Yes, and then you went on to say, with regard to Marx, he expected finance to become part of the industrial economy and thereby rescued from its historically predatory behavior. With regard to Marx's long-term perspective, industrial capitalism is not evolving into socialism, but into a parasitic and extractive finance capitalism. One therefore can say that the greatest tragedy to befall industrial capitalism is its failure to evolve into socialism. Instead, it is retrogressing into the neo-feudalism of debt peonage to a financial oligarchy.
Couldn't have said it better myself. at the New School, I used theories of surplus value as my textbook for national income accounting. Heilbronner refused to let me teach the course again and brought in a bunch of Stalinist thugs, one of whom committed suicide under LSD, and essentially forbid me to teach what Marx wrote in order that he could teach his own Stalinist version of Marxism.
When was this?
From 1969 to 1972. Basically, in 1971 and 2, I was teaching a national income course at the graduate faculty of the new school, and using Terence McCarthy's translation of the theories of surplus values, my textbook. This brought huge protests from the Stalinist faculty.
You've also written that for the oligarchy, the crisis is over. They won. They have all the money. $5 trillion is enough to create a new ruling class in America for the next century. What is the crisis? You say it's not a financial crisis, but a political crisis. Could you explain that?
Well, the crisis basically was financial at root. It's the inability to pay. The debts far exceeded the ability to pay. Now, for the last few hundred years, actually for the last 4,000 years, when people couldn't pay, the debts either were wiped out or property owners forfeited their property to foreclosing creditors. But one way or another, the debts went way down. This crisis is different. And the Bush and the Obama administration are handling things in an identical fashion. There seems to be no difference at all between the Republicans and the Democrats here. Now, politically, the government says, okay, we know that the debts are in advance of the ability to pay. Let's have the government issue as many treasury bonds as it can, give all of us gamblers for derivative trade, give us the people who've played the derivative market, played the futures market, betting against currencies and exchange rates and stock market prices. Let's give all the money to all of the winners, and then let the economy essentially collapse. We'll take the money, and some of it we'll use to buy property. Some of it we'll move abroad if we can find the market. We'll try to move some into China. We'll move some into the third world. We'll buy natural resources. We'll take the money and run. And essentially, for the last year, the Treasury policy has been for the financial sector and the hedge funds and the gamblers who are rich enough to invest in hedge funds to try to get as much money as they can, grab it now, and let the economy shrink.
You have also said that this crisis has happened before, for example, in the Roman Republic.
Yes, in Rome, what happened was that 25% of the population was reduced to bondage or slavery and impoverished by the creditors. And if you'd lost your land to a foreclosing creditor, you had to find someone to be a patron for you, and you'd be a client of a patron, and you'd say, okay, here I am, I can fight, you know, I'll be loyal to you, give me a plot on your land, and all I want is the ability to grow enough food to feed my family, and grow enough wool to weave clothes and, you know, to provide for us. And so you had the large creditors who made their financial fortunes would all plow their money back into the land. They'd buy land because owning land was the ability to offer clients a means of subsistence. And at the end of this road was the Dark Age. The Roman wealthy class didn't put its money into making more industry or handicraft or expansion. It left foreign trade largely in the hands of Near Easterners and merchants, and so you had life de-urbanize and retreat to self-sufficient estates on the land, which is where most of the handicraft workshops were resettled. The weaving was done on the land, the cloth making was done on the land, the food was produced there, and essentially you had a lapse back into a subsistence economy as the financial sector just stripped whatever ability there was to produce, and especially Rome stripped its colonies in Asia Minor, what's now Turkey, and anywhere else that it could just extract that tribute from. And the whole Roman Empire in the West was stripped. It survived in the East, in Byzantium. And so while Western Europe fell into feudalism, the Byzantine Empire was the one part that survived until the Crusades mounted a military attack and looted Byzantium and Constantinople and seized its gold and silver. and use this to create banking fortunes that were lent out to kingdoms to wage war against each other. And then you had the public debt development that we discussed earlier in the interview.
Well, if we're heading, if it looks like we're heading back into debt peonage, what measures should labor take? I mean, what do you think ideally people should do at this point?
Well, obviously, the idea of investing pensions in the stock market isn't going to work if the money that you're saving and putting into the stock market goes down and down in price. Suppose you've been working for 20 years, putting your money in. Last year's stock market decline has wiped out 10 years of your saving. So that's not what to do. You want a the same thing with Social Security. The government pretended that it was imposing the FICA wage withholding in order to save up money for Social Security, but what it really did was provide the Treasury with money that it could afford tax cuts on the rich. So labor should say, look, we want to take the German rule. We want a pay-as-you-go Social Security, pay it out of taxes, not out of our wages, but out of a return to progressive taxation, even what you had in the Clinton era, but ideally what you had in the Reagan era, when at least you had the remnants of a progressive tax system before the Democrats under Clinton slashed taxes. And you want to essentially finance Social Security and medical care out of progressive taxation that falls mainly on the rich. So they want to return to that. They want to raise the capital gains tax so it's taxed at least as high as normal income, preferably at a higher rate of normal income, because you want companies to earn a profit by actually producing goods and services. You don't want them to make capital gains by buying and selling other companies and financial manipulation, which is what creates the finance capital gains. So those are the two big things. And you also, if you're labor, you want to stop the tax deductibility of interest payments. You want to shift the economy away from a debt-oriented economy towards an equity-oriented economy, just as was suggested by the Sansimonians and endorsed by almost all the 19th century classical economists. So you're going to want to restore those three basic planks of classical economics.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show has been The Financial Barbarians at the Gate. Dr. Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. He is also author of The Myth of Aid, and Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order. Dr. Hudson has been a consultant to foreign governments including Canada, Mexico, and Russia. Visit his website at www.michael-hudson.com. That's michael-hudson, H-U-D-S-O-N.com. Guns and Butter is produced and edited by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. To leave comments or order copies of shows, call 510-848-6767, extension 628, or email us at blfaulkner@yahoo.com. That's blfaulkner@yahoo.com. Our website, gunsandbutter.net, is under reconstruction.
And a new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? All you sleeping souls, wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying?
Bonnie wanted folks to know that there's an event happening. What in the world is high-tech explosive material doing in the dust clouds generated on 9/11? That's a presentation by physics professor Stephen Jones. It's going to be at the UC Davis Lecture Hall, the Social Science Lecture Hall, on Friday at 7 p.m. May 1st. The night before, he'll be at the Colonial Heights branch of the Sacramento Public Library, 7 p.m. Thursday, April 30th. Two lectures by Professor Stephen Jones on what in the world is high-tech explosive material doing in the dust clouds of 9/11.
Spring is here, so why not get in the mood with the Berkeley Broadway Singers? Berkeley Broadway Singers Wheelchair Accessible Benefit Spring Concerts under the direction of Ellen Hoffman take place Saturday, April 25th at 8 p.m. at St. Ambrose in Berkeley and Sunday, April 26th at 4 p.m. at St. Augustine's in Oakland. For more information about how to get in the mood with the Berkeley Broadway Singers, call 510-604-5600.